Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 1st, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner and check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the Islands. Kristen, let's start this week with the news that a coalition of local groups wants a portion of the new short-term rentals tax to be dedicated to long-term regional improvements. Start by telling us who the groups are.
So there are four regional organizations that have come together to support this idea, and those include the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, the Cape Cod and Islands Association of Realtors, and the Housing Assistance Corps. And as you mentioned, this is called the Future Cape Cod Coalition, and what they're asking is that each of the 15 Cape towns considers adopting a bylaw that would set up a special fund to pay for things like housing, wastewater, broadband, transportation, and marketing. They say that Cape Cod towns are poised to receive this once-in-a-generation revenue infusion thanks to this new short-term rentals law, and that they don't want to see this go into, you know, this money that's coming in necessarily go into just the general fund of these towns, that the towns could really use it for these things that have been considered really important, like underfunded infrastructure projects and community investment. So what the coalition has done is they've drafted a model bylaw for the towns that would direct at least 50% of revenue from this new tax to an Infrastructure and Community Investment Stabilization Fund. That fund would then be able to pay for those things like the housing and wastewater, broadband, etc. Andrew Gottlieb, who's the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, said again that setting aside this new revenue before it gets absorbed into the general operating budget is really important.
Explain the law for us, the short-term rental law. What kinds of things is it outlining here?
So this law was signed by Charlie Baker on December 28th, and it took effect on January 1st. And what it does is it taxes properties that are rented out for more than 2 weeks of a season for terms that are shorter than 31 days. And the law's really expected to deliver a lot of money for the state and for the towns. It's estimated at to draw revenues of $34.5 million for state coffers and about $25.5 million that would go directly to the towns.
So this is for things like Airbnb, typically, is what people think of this as.
Yeah, these short-term rentals
short-term
that
rentals.
You know, sometimes people can find online,
yeah.
And you know, people rent their homes out for extra money when they're not using them. And towns have a few options here. They can levy a 4-6% tax on short-term rentals, and if that's not designated, the money would go into the town's free cash. But the towns could also tax short-term rentals up to 14.45%. The types of funds, though, if the coalition is successful in getting the towns to sign on to this bylaw, the types of projects that this money could be used to pay for, they say, are ones that the towns will have to face anyway, and that they really should use this opportunity to create this fund. It would work in a way that's similar to Community Preservation Act funds. Those are tax dollars that are set aside and can only be used for things like open space, historical sites, affordable housing, and outdoor recreation. This would do something sort of similar, but would be used for those infrastructure and community investment projects.
And there's a way in which these infrastructure projects, the towns have to scale them up because of the tourist economy here. And so having the tourist economy pay for a lot of these projects makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, in some instances, like you said, these towns that, you know, maybe have a smaller year-round population, they still will have to build their wastewater systems, for example, to meet those needs of when they have that summer influx. And again, this is a way of having the tourists help cover those costs. That's why these groups are saying, or the coalition is saying, that these towns should come together and really realize how important and what a great opportunity this is.
The towns themselves, how are they responding to this proposal and to the idea of getting all this potential new revenue?
Yeah, so the towns are still really looking at how they could possibly use this money. Province towns talked about using the proceeds to help pay for a new police station and housing. Orleans is thinking about creating a wastewater stabilization fund. And some of the towns have said, you know, even if we did want to adopt a bylaw like this, a lot of the town meeting warrants have already closed, meaning that they wouldn't necessarily be able to take it up in the spring. Gottlieb, however, said that even if the warrants have been otherwise closed, technically there's still time for selectmen to add an article that they sponsor before the warrants sent off to be printed, and that usually happens about a month before town meeting. In Mashpee, that town administrator confirmed that they've received the coalition's letter, but the selectmen haven't discussed it. An article on the special town meeting warrant there would basically create the same type of fund for 75% of its revenue rental, but it wouldn't include that broadband idea that was talked about by the coalition. Yarmouth also received the letter, and they're still kind of working out what they want to do with the short-term rental tax in general. The selectmen have not talked about the model bylaw.
You can understand that for the towns, this is all new, too. The law is just signed by the governor at the end of last year, and they're taking a little bit of a cautious approach as they try to figure out what this money is going to mean potentially for the towns. Let's talk about another story this week. A number of Cape Cod officials were in Boston on Wednesday, and they went to the big city to talk about what else? They went to talk about sharks and what to do about them on the Cape.
Yes, they did. So this meeting was organized by Senator Julian Cyr from Truro and State Rep Sarah Peake from Provincetown. And Cyr said that this is really, he described it as an all-hands-on-deck meeting. He said there were stakeholders from across the region, and really that officials, even at the state level, realized that because the Cape is such a strong tourist destination that draws in money for the state, that this isn't just a local issue, that it really affects the whole state. There were about 50 people who attended the meeting.
50 people. This is a big meeting.
Yeah, 50 people. And that's not people coming in from the public who are, you know, wanting to talk about it. These are people like the town administrators, all the town administrators from the Cape's lower six towns that are affected most by sharks, along with municipal public safety officers, representatives from the tourism industry, scientists who were there to talk about research, the head officials from the Cape Cod National Seashore, and the entire Cape legislative delegation. And they met with staff from Governor Charlie Baker's office, and also some other state agencies like the Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs, the House Ways and Means Committee, and as well, Representative William Keating was there, along with State Senator Edward Markey and Elizabeth Warren.
Or staff from their offices.
Yeah, I'm sorry, staff from their offices were there. They were not necessarily there themselves. And really, Wendy Northcross, who's the CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, said that it was a really positive meeting. She said, again, that these state officials and state agencies were understanding that it's not just a Cape issue and that it's a state issue. And that goes, again, back to the tax dollars. The Cape is one of the top revenue generators from the state, and that includes $47.4 million in tax receipts that were given to the state in 2016. That estimate also, we just talked about that short-term rental tax, that has the possibility to send, as we mentioned earlier, another $34.5 million to the state treasury. So it's really in the state's interest as well to make sure that those tourism dollars stay kind of where they're at and that people aren't worried about what our response here is to sharks. So the six town administrators and managers from the Cape Cod National Seashore presented a letter to Governor Baker that outlined where these Cape towns need some assistance. And that was really at the crux of this here. The letter requested...
Tell us, there's a long list here. Tell us what some of the items that they're looking at.
Yeah, so they're looking specifically for those emergency call boxes that can be directly wired into the 911 system, and that's similar to those that you'd find on college campuses. They also want satellite phones for all town lifeguards. They want utility terrain vehicles that can deliver emergency personnel and supplies to the potential victim of a shark attack and also transport that victim back to rescue vehicles. They also want additional funding for shark research, and there's kind of all sorts of research things that they were looking at here. They were talking about the tagging effort, behavioral studies that could look at shark movement in shallow water and at depths where swimming and surfing occur. They want to look at federal dollars for a study by the Division of Marine Fisheries and the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, along with some others that would look at the sharks' use of nearshore structures like troughs, sandbars, and channels, and also assistance for efforts to educate the public on risks and response to shark attacks.
So in essence, they're asking for money for all of these things.
Yes,
the state,
always comes down to money.
It comes down to money. And the state, it's what kind of response did they have for this?
Well, so they sort of responded positively, I think, was the general takeaway. But they also said that there have been no concrete funding sources promised or identified at the meeting. State revenues right now appear to be a little bit short of what was expected, to the tune of $200 to $300 million short of estimates. So the state officials are being sort of fiscally cautious right now. Some of the capital items, though, that are on the town's list, such as the satellite phones and the call boxes, might be able to be purchased through existing capital funding. So they're hoping to get some of those things in place by this summer.
We're going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, in Chatham, there's a lot of concern about the loss of historic homes and more modest homes being replaced with much bigger homes and what kind of impact that has on the community. Now there's talk of limiting perhaps the size of homes that could be built, and that's an issue and a question that I think many towns wonder about. Tell us what's happening here.
Sure. As you said, there's been this concern here and, of course, throughout the Cape for quite a while now, as the more modest homes, built in the 50s, 60s, are torn down to make way for larger houses that end up being seasonal instead of year-round. One of the Chatham Selectmen's goals for this year is to encourage residential development that is in keeping with the town's historic nature. And to do that, they tasked the planning board to come up with a zoning bylaw which would limit the scale of residential structures. This is something that's been discussed here and in a lot of other towns for many years, and communities kind of shied away from it, although I know Truro has a bylaw that relates to this, and I think there are a few others around. But currently, Chatham's bylaw limits the coverage of lots. In other words, the amount of the land area of the lot that can be covered by either houses or impervious surfaces like driveways, and those range from about 17% to about 10%. And right now, that's the only limit on the size of a building. And the larger the lot, obviously, the larger the building you can fit on there. But with limited open land available now for development, most of most of what we're seeing here in Chatham is teardowns, and officials are worried that that's going to lead to overbuilding of a lot of these neighborhoods. So the planning board has started a discussion on trying to figure out how they can get at this issue. Member Tom Gagan said the other day during the discussion that this is going to have a major impact on land values, and they're going to have to watch how they get at this, because that's going to bring out really opposition from developers and many, many property owners, too. Other members of the planning board suggested that since most parcels in Chatham are non-conforming, any changes like this have to go to the Zoning Board of Appeals, so they're going to need the ZBA to buy into this and stop sort of granting wholesale relief for larger homes. Another board member, Bob Dubas, warned that any measure is going to have to go through town meetings, so residents are going to have to feel that this is worthwhile and that it's not too restrictive. Chairman Catherine Halpern suggested that the first step should be to analyze the historic size of residential homes in Chatham, which have varied from times when the economy wasn't good, there were small homes, and times when the economy was better, or you have a lot of captains' houses that are pretty large. So there's quite a range, and they're going to be looking to see if they can scrape together some money to perhaps bring the Cape Cod Commission in on this to help with that analysis, so they have a sort of a factual basis that they can use in looking at this issue. So they're going to be taking up this topic again March 12th. I don't anticipate that they'd have anything ready for this year's town meeting, but I'm sure that the discussions will go on towards probably something in about a year from now.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll have more for you, and we'll speak with Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker, and joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Kristen, a crowd turned out to the Barnstable County Commissioners meeting this week. They came to speak out about the actions of one of the commissioners, but that commissioner didn't show up for the meeting.
Yes, so this was the largest crowd to attend the commissioner's meeting in recent memory. And they were there to protest a tweet by County Commissioner Ronald Beattie Jr. that questioned whether gay politicians are, quote, too self-absorbed and self-centered, end quote, to adequately represent all constituents fairly. Now, they got there and there was this group of about 75 people. It overflowed the room and extended into another room. But about 35 minutes before the start of the session, Beattie wrote an email to County Administrator John Jack Unitas Jr. that said that due to a significant medical problem that arose unexpectedly, he would be unable to attend the meeting. So even though he wasn't there, 15 people still addressed the board during the public comment period. And they talked to two other commissioners, Chairman Ronald Bergstrom and Mary Pat Flynn, who listened as these people were, you know, expressing their thoughts about this tweet.
And many of them had brought out signs. They were very publicly, visibly upset with Beattie and his comments.
Yes, this has drawn a lot of attention since the tweet came out. There have been calls for his resignation by all across the spectrum, Democrats and Republicans, who have come out and said that, you know, this is not appropriate behavior for a county commissioner. At the meeting, none of the speakers defended or supported Beattie, although some did recognize his First Amendment right to free speech. And that's also a defense that Beattie has reiterated when he's tried to counter those calls for his resignation. The speakers, though, most of them did say that as an elected official, Beattie should be held to higher standards and be more responsible and appropriate when making comments and remarks. There was one person there, the senior class president, actually, from Nauset High School, who said that he thought it was pretty coward-like for Beattie not to show up. The student, Ben Nigel, who will be studying political science at Harvard in the fall, said he was actually blocked from Beattie's Twitter account after replying to the tweet, and that led him to question whether Beattie was really committed to the free speech rights of others. Others spoke. A woman from Marston's Mills, who addressed the board along with her husband, said that, yes, citizens do have the right to free speech, but as an elected official, you also have the duty to serve all of your constituents, and that because Beattie had made such a discriminatory statement, she questioned whether Beattie could adequately represent all of the constituents in a fair and equitable manner.
What responses Beattie had to all of this?
So Beattie, when he was contacted by email for comments, said he hadn't yet viewed the meeting, but he again insisted that he would not apologize and wouldn't consider resigning. He said that, as he had stated previously, that in November 2020, at the same time that Trump will be up for re-election, Cape Cod voters will be the ones who decide whether or not he'll be re-elected as county commissioners. There were also some appeals for a censure on things that commissioners say. Bergstrom said that he's waiting for a decision on a censure ordinance that's currently being considered by the county's legislative branch, the Assembly of Delegates. If that is approved by the Assembly, it would then go to the commissioners for review and action.
Let's speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, Casey. Wellfleet Town Manager Dan Hort gave his State of the Town address recently, and one of the interesting things to come out of that had to do with shark safety and some advice from the town council who's concerned about liability. Tell us about this.
Okay, sure. So as everyone knows, the first fatal shark attack in Massachusetts in more than 80 years occurred in Wellfleet's Newcomb Hollow Beach in September. And since then, the Wellfleet Town Administrator, Dan Hort, has been tasked with dealing with the real threat of more shark attacks on the town's beaches. And he's also coping with the perceived threat, which is extremely damaging to a wider swath of people. And that is, if tourists stop coming to Wellfleet because they believe the beaches are unsafe, that will hurt the restaurants, new home construction, hotels, Airbnb rentals, virtually everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So when Dan Hort called KP Law, which is the town council for that town, for advice on shark safety measures that he might be able to take, the lawyers advised him that doing nothing is actually the safest move in terms of opening the town up to liability in the case of another shark fatality or injury.
Explain that for us. Why would doing nothing be the safest move?
Well, as the lawyer told him, as a town, you are better off if you do nothing. If you do stuff and you start to give people the impression that they are safer in the water and they're not, then you become liable if something happens again. And as most of us also now know, no shark repellent measures have been shown to work reliably. So making an investment and making a promise or a claim about something that may or may not help is a very tough call. And so he's in a tough position. And that said, there are some steps that Wellfleet is definitely going to be taking. One is the town is conducting Stop the Bleed trainings for staff and interested members of the public. The town is also installing landline telephone call boxes at each of the Ocean Beach parking lot, because another problem about the beaches is there's no reliable cell phone service. And number three, Dan Hort will be asking town meeting voters to buy a small vehicle that will hold a stretcher so that you're able to get a person up the sloping dunes to a rescue vehicle much, much, much more quickly. So poor cell phone service, deep dunes, these were all seen as part of the magic of the remote and untamable Outer Cape beaches, and now these aspects are real deterrents now that we've got this shark threat is so real for us.
And tell us about what it means to the town to have this reputation perhaps growing that it's a shark, that if you come to Wellfleet, it might not be safe to swim.
It's hard to say, but obviously it's huge. I mean, the parking revenue for the town beaches is a tremendous driver. And really, I mean, Wellfleet is all about its beaches, its surf culture, it's the Beachcomber bar that's right on the dunes on the ocean side. These are just so iconic. There's ponds in Wellfleet too, but I mean really the beaches in Wellfleet are just a tremendous draw for people. So this would be all encompassing.
And are they responding to this perceived threat to Wellfleet's brand, I guess?
Yeah, and Dan Hort said he wants to do some kind of marketing campaign to reach out to people, and so that's something that's definitely being talked about. And it's funny because some other Wellfleetians are saying, "Really, we're crowded enough. You don't need to do anything." But Dan's response is a lot of people depend on renting their houses out to pay their mortgages, and there just has to be some way to counteract if there is a real chilling effect on the summer tourism market, then there has to be some kind of marketing campaign to respond to that.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good day.
Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times is with me. Kristen, a recent incident at a Mexican restaurant in Falmouth in which a man wearing a political slogan ball cap was allegedly assaulted. This has gotten a fair amount of attention, both in social media and in the press. We haven't talked about this yet on the roundup, so maybe you could start by telling us what we know about what happened here.
Sure. So 41-year-old Rosie Ann Santos was arrested on February 15th by Falmouth police after she allegedly assaulted a man wearing a hat. And again, it was bearing that Make America Great Again campaign slogan.
Which is associated with Donald Trump.
Yes. And this happened at Casa Vallarta, which is a Mexican restaurant on Davis Straits. She pleaded not guilty February 20th in Falmouth District Court to charges of assault and battery and disorderly conduct. But on Tuesday, she was arrested by deportation officers with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Fugitive Operations Team. She was later released, but she was given a notice to appear before an immigration judge. And a statement from ICE said that Santos was unlawfully present and that she's a citizen of Brazil. Reporter spoke with Santos's immigration attorney, however, who said that Santos is in this country legally and that despite a long history of driving infractions since she got her Massachusetts license in 1996, that she's never been convicted of anything that would jeopardize her a green card. Santos is a citizen of Brazil, but her attorney, whose name is Katrina Kasakova, said that she has a green card application pending and is married to a U.S. citizen and that therefore she is here in an authorized state. Kasakova said she's representing Santos on immigration matters, but not in the Falmouth assault case. In that case, a man told the police that he had been minding his own business when Santos began verbally accosting him because of the hat. The man pulled out his phone and recorded the incident, and you can see on the video that Santos walks behind him and hits his hat off his head. Santos told police that the man should not have been allowed in a Mexican restaurant wearing that hat and referred to the man as an expletive for supporting Trump, and that's according to a police report. Police said that she was highly intoxicated and uncooperative during her arrest. And as officers escorted Santos from the restaurant, she hit the man over the head again. Again, that's according to the police report. There were 4 pages of violations on her driving record that was provided by the Registry of Motor Vehicles. And that extended from 1996 to the present. It included more than 20 violations against Santos for speeding, failing to stop at a stop sign, marked lane violations, and also driving an unregistered vehicle. The list also cited 2 accidents with property damage and about a half dozen payment defaults that were later paid off. Those infractions, though, will have ultimately no impact on her immigration proceedings. That's according to her attorney.
The towns of Dennis and Yarmouth, which you cover for the Cape Cod Times, have been in a struggle for some time now over how they split costs in their shared regional school district. This conflict appears perhaps to be coming to a head as Yarmouth has filed a lawsuit and there's a hard deadline from the state that could mean the district might lose out on about $44 million. Tell us what's going on here.
Yes, so there is this looming deadline of April 11th, and that's the day when, in order to qualify for $44.3 million that this new proposed $117 million middle school is eligible for, district officials would need to sign a letter of commitment for the project by that date, April 11th. However, they can't do so if there's litigation or even the threat of litigation related to the project. And so just to give you a little background here, The middle school was approved December 4th in a district-wide election, and the approval margin was just about 25 votes district-wide.
Between the two towns.
Yeah, cumulative 25 votes. But about 57% of Yarmouth voters turned down the proposal. And Yarmouth since then has really stuck to its guns and said, we want to follow the will of our voters, regardless of, you know, whether there's this district-wide approval of the slight, you know, by 25 votes. They did file a lawsuit. The town of Yarmouth filed a lawsuit on February 5th against the school committee and the town of Dennis, and that was over the committee's decision to bypass a town meeting vote on the project.
But behind all of this really is this contention about who's paying for what in the school district, right? And that's kind of what's driving a lot of this.
A lot of officials have come right out and said, Yarmouth doesn't really care how the school was approved. That's not what's at the heart of the lawsuit. What's at the heart of the lawsuit is this regional agreement that's been a point of discussion and contention between the towns for years. Yarmouth officials have long maintained that it unfairly burdens Yarmouth taxpayers. It assesses enrollment based on the number of students that each town sends to DY schools. However, it doesn't count students that live in Dennis or Yarmouth but attend charter schools or go to public choice elsewhere. And that actually, the district is expected to spend about $3.3 million this year on those categories of students, a lot of which come from Dennis. So Yarmouth is saying, you know, among other things, that they want this to be changed to foundation enrollment. There are also some other things like administrative costs that they say shouldn't be divided by enrollment because you'd have them no matter how many kids were in the school. Mm-hmm. You'd have to pay for things like a principal and a vice principal, and that Dennis should be sharing those costs equally, along with kind of a long list of other concessions that they're hoping for Dennis to make. And on February 15th, Norman Holcomb, who's the chairman of the Yarmouth Board of Selectmen, wrote a letter to Dennis Selectmen. And what he said in the letter is that he'd sort of discussed this a little bit with Paul McCormick, who's the chairman of the Dennis Board, about the idea of maybe being able to call a special town meeting in each town to get a new agreement passed prior to the April 11th deadline.
Yeah. Which is coming up quick.
It's coming up quick. It's, I think, about 40 days away. So it's really not a lot of time here. But what the letter also said, it came right out and said that if this new agreement could be approved before the deadline, Yarmouth will drop the lawsuit. That letter, I think, although it may have been an attempt to kind of nudge Dennis to continue negotiating, there were a lot of emotional reactions to that at a recent Dennis Selectman meeting last week. Several Dennis Selectmen, including John Terrio, came right out and called the letter blackmail. He said, you know, this is enough is enough. This is an attempt to blackmail Dennis, and it's not a good faith negotiation. The letter included a worksheet that listed Yarmouth's position on 11 proposed amendments to the agreement, and then also offered a space for Dennis to indicate whether it would agree or provide a counter offer. The Dennis board member said they've tried to be fair and equitable in negotiating changes. Last month, they did send another letter saying that they would agree. They sent a letter to the school committee, actually, saying that they would agree to that foundation enrollment change, making the change in the way students are counted, but they stopped short of agreeing to a lot of the things Yarmouth has asked for. The school committee is also trying to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. They've got had a subcommittee. They agreed last month to form a 3-member subcommittee that's going to draft its own proposal for the agreement and then propose it to both towns. And they've said, you know, this isn't going to be something, everything Yarmouth wants or everything Dennis wants. It's going to be a meet-in-the-middle sort of proposal that the school committee thinks is equitable. But there's questions over, no matter who sort of reaches an agreement, whether there's still time left to approve it before April 11th. Yarmouth Selectmen can call a special town meeting at any time, although it does have to be posted 14 days in advance. But Dennis has a whole host of issues why this might not actually happen. Selectmen there are required to provide at least 7 weeks' notice when they call a special town meeting. So that's kind of out of the question. There is a law that allows citizens to petition a special town meeting with shorter notice, but even that, it's questionable whether it's possible. Parents and students, though, are saying they came up to both selectmen meetings this past week, and they said, we want you guys to just put the past aside and find a solution. Parents in Yarmouth said, you know, stop waiting for Dennis to agree to what you want. Do what's right. You could right here, right now, publicly drop the suit, mm-hmm. and we could, you know, solve this problem, and then you could negotiate with Dennis later on. And then in Dennis, they said, you know, we're asking you guys to continue coming to the table and talking to Yarmouth. Maybe you should give a little bit more than just the foundation enrollment, and we can get this solved, and you know, that school and that funding would then and it would make it a sure thing. So.
In the meantime, about 5 weeks left to go to figure it out.
Yes.
Or they lose that money. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And with us on the phone right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Kristen.
Good morning.
George, one of the big stories of the week was the Aquinnah Wampanoag tribe on the island beginning work on its proposed electronic bingo hall. There's plenty of contention about this, and not just about bringing gambling to the island, but also the way this is being pursued. You had an opportunity to speak with the tribal chairman about this. Tell us what's happening.
That's right. So this all started with both the town of Aquinnah, the town of Chilmark, asking the MVC, which is the Martha's Vineyard Commission, to look at this project as a development of regional impact. There's no question that this particular project is going to have an impact on Aquinnah, which virtually doesn't have any commercial activity. But the difference here is that the tribe is a federally recognized tribe. Their land is in federal trust, so they have certain rights on their reservation land. And one of them is to have gaming under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. There's been a long legal battle on this that started back in 2012 when the law went into effect in Massachusetts for expanded gambling. The tribe actually wanted to have an off-island casino, wanted to negotiate with then-Governor Deval Patrick. He said no. That's what prompted the tribe to look at a casino on its own land.
Describe for us what exactly they're proposing, what the scale of this thing is, this electronic bingo hall.
Yeah, so it's relatively small compared to other casino operations that you might know of or have seen. Only about 1,500 gaming machines in a small facility. This is going to be a temporary facility, Cheryl told me. It's
About 250 electronic gaming machines?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Thank you. And just for comparison, there are the facility in Plain Ridge, I think, has 2,500. That gives you a little perspective that this is going to be a much smaller operation than something like that. She says they're doing this temporary facility to see just what the market will bear. You know, they're not even sure. In court documents, they've said that they might be able to generate about $4.5 million per year. But she said that, you know, they just don't know how many people are going to come to Aquinnah to bet on these electronic bingo machines. Go ahead.
There's a lot of concern about oversight on the project, the Martha's Vineyard Commission wanting to weigh in because it does have this potential impact to be on the whole region. And also the town of Chilmark has concerns about the added traffic that may be coming through Chilmark and the burden that may bring to the town.
Absolutely. Traffic, law enforcement, all of those things. The tribe says they're willing to sit down and talk to the towns. They're willing to sit down and talk to the commission, but they're not going to be told, you know, how to do their project. That's the key difference here. They believe that they're under federal regulations, that they'll do their building codes, their environmental impact, and all of that under federal regulations and not be dictated by the Martha's Vineyard Commission. Interestingly, the commission is going to have a couple of representatives sit down with the tribe informally. And we also just learned that Aquinnah Board of Selectmen will have a meeting on Tuesday, and they have the casino project on their agenda, both during the regular session. They also have an executive session planned. You know, there's talk of litigation again. But this went to all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided not to hear the case. So, you know, just what legal action might be taken, you know, remains to be seen. But this has already been litigated, and that's the tribe's stance, you know, that they're on firm ground here because it has been – their settlement agreement with the state has been litigated, and they're saying we don't have to go to the commission. They want to work with other island towns. They want – you know, they're willing to even pay their fair share for public safety and any traffic improvements. But they say so far, when they've talked to officials, they're asking for a little bit too much.
The tribe has many members who don't live in Aquinnah, and it sounds like there's some contention about the support of tribe members who are in Aquinnah for this, which might not be very strong, and the support of tribe members who don't live on island, who live off island, who may have a lot more support for seeing this going forward.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. Jeffrey Madison, who's the town administrator in Aquinnah, he's a tribal member. And he says that he doesn't know of anybody who lives in Aquinnah and is a member of the tribe who supports this. Cheryl Andrews-Maltes, who's the chairwoman, she says she disagrees with that. But there are quite a few members of the tribe who do live off island, places like Fall River, New Bedford, you know, southeastern Massachusetts. And, you know, let's not forget, many of them have been forced to leave the island because of the high cost of living on the island. And that's one of the things that the tribe says a casino will benefit them, you know, being able to provide services, to be able to provide housing for their members to live on the island, to work mm-hmm. on the island. So it's interesting. It's going to, you know, we'll see how this all shakes out in the days, weeks, and months ahead, you know, and the tribe is still willing to talk to the state about an off-island casino, which, you know, in southeastern Massachusetts, is, as Kristen knows, working for the Cape Cod Times, is still very much in flux with the Mashpee tribe.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Kristen Young with me from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, there was good news for some local organizations as the state announced this week $3 million in grants going to Cape Maritime projects.
Yes, so these are all going to go toward improving maritime research, emergency preparedness, and educational efforts across Cape Cod. The grants include $1 million for the creation of a state-of-the-art marine research complex in Falmouth, another $1 million for the development of a coastal emergency management simulator at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy, and $1 million for an interactive exhibit on the historical and contemporary role of the blue economy on Cape Cod. The Mass Maritime grant will partner with $6,000 from the Academy's operational funds, and that will go toward building a 2,400 square foot simulator that it's a simulated command center where students and other emergency officials can practice natural disaster response in Massachusetts. It will be open to undergraduate and graduate students, along with emergency responders who might be affected by severe weather in the region. And once it's up and running, it's supposedly going to be one of the only one of its kind in Massachusetts that's ready and available for use by the public and for the Academy's students. Commodore Bradley Lima of the Academy said that the simulator will not only help put the region in a better position to respond in a national disaster, but it will also put the school's emergency management program head and shoulders above others being offered. The goal is to have it fully operational also by the fall of 2020. And then in the Falmouth waterfront, this grant will go to supporting the next phase of planning to develop a state-of-the-art complex for waterfront access to exploration and research. Once that's built, the facility will support oceanography for the next 50 years or longer.
That's at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
Yes,
it's kind of a big new dock front for them.
It is, yes. And so this grant, it will kind of build on previous grants that were received for this project, and it will develop a detailed design and engineering plan for the facility. The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is also partnering with the town of Falmouth on this. And Robert Munier, who's vice president of marine facilities and operations at the institution, said that the town's also very interested in the waterfront, particularly because of sea level rise and how that will affect the overall community. And this is a really big project. This is supposed to be only one phase out of what will become a $70 million project. And that's according to Munier. Then lastly, this blue economy, this grant focused on the blue economy will also be focused on the ocean. The project there is called Expedition Blue, and it will create a network of interconnected sites across the region where participants can learn about the maritime heritage of the modern blue economy. Physical structures called activators are going to be placed at key locations like ferry terminals or at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and they'll teach visitors about what they're seeing and about what possible career opportunities there are in the blue economy. That project is shovel-ready and will take a little more than a year to complete.
The group that proposed a needle exchange in Falmouth, which was shut down by community opposition, is returning to Falmouth for a pair of public forums. They've had one already, and this is to kind of engage the community in what their mission is as they continue to look for a site to open an exchange.
Yes, so this group had stumbled onto quite a bit of opposition from an earlier proposal to open up a needle exchange near St. Anthony's Church, and that was in a residential area. So they kind of took a step back. They've planned these two forums that are, as you mentioned, for the purpose of letting the public know what they do and kind of maybe taking some of the stigma off of this. One of these meetings was held on Tuesday, and they talked about their services, which included things like guidance in securing medical benefits or Medicare connections, help with basics such as housing and food transportation to medical visits, and mental health and substance abuse assessments. The major service, though, that has been the biggest point of contention was that needle exchange program. And that drew heated objections from residents at previous meetings over the lack of public input in the organization's plans to open up that previous site. So about 25 people attended this forum Tuesday, which was held at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation. And those who were there did say that the session went a long way toward giving them a better understanding of what the AIDS support group offers. The group currently operates in Hyannis and Provincetown, and it is, as we mentioned, looking to expand into Falmouth. The Massachusetts Department of Health issued an advisory on February 5th that says that it's actually detected an increase in newly diagnosed HIV infections among people who inject drugs.
I thought this was fascinating.
Yeah.
This is an uptick in HIV infections in drug users, intravenous drug users.
Yes, and I think that this group, one of the things they've said is that their purpose here with the needle exchange program is to help prevent that from happening here. Dan Gates, who's the AIDS support group's chief operations officer, said that the possibility of a cluster of cases is increased in areas when there are no needle exchange programs available. And so the residents who turned out to this meeting, though, weren't all still in favor of what the group is proposing. Resident Michael Halen, who's been an outspoken critic of the AIDS support group's proposal to open in Falmouth, said that the recent clash between the organization and the East Falmouth neighborhood where the clinic was going to operate, he referenced that, and he said that the group CEO, Joseph Carleo, had called the hardworking people of East Falmouth hateful and angry people. And Carleo responded saying that basically that's how it appeared to us. They were receiving so much negative feedback that they had decided not to open in that location because the staff thought that it may not be safe for their staff members and for patients who were coming to access these services. That's a big part of the reason why they pulled back the
proposal. They perceived threats coming from the community.
Yes, exactly. So he said, it did look hateful and angry, basically, is what he said Tuesday. However, Dan Gates, who is the COO, sort of stepped in to diffuse things. He said, the group hadn't anticipated this level of pushback from the town. He said things didn't start out well, but we're trying to change that. We want to engage better with town people and see what those concerns really are and see how we can address them. The next forum is scheduled for 5:30 on March 26th at the Falmouth Public Library.
The Cape Cod agency that founded the local Head Start program, which helps children from low-income families, will not automatically be awarded that contract when the renewal comes up in the fall. Tell us about this.
Yes, that's correct. So in October, a federal investigation had found a host of problems with the Head Start program. And now Cape Cod Child Development will have to compete with other agencies that might want the contract, which is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they're only even going to be eligible to compete for that contract if Cape Cod Child Development corrects deficiencies that had been reported by federal investigators in October. And that includes the lack of oversight of federal funds and significant issues with understaffing that was creating a really big problems at this at these daycare centers. Teachers in the program had complained that they were working under conditions that were extremely stressful and chaotic. 3- and 4-year-olds in the program were routinely hitting and biting each other with really not much staff intervention at all, according to the report. And managers who were supposed to be overseeing higher level functions were reduced to meal prep and cleanup. And really what happened here is the Administration for Children and Families determined that if the deficiency findings are corrected, the Office of Head Start, that Cape Cod Child Development will be required to compete for that continued funding. If they're not corrected, then they'll be out of the running. They'll be cut from even being allowed to compete for this contract again. And it's unclear yet whether Cape Cod Child Development has corrected all the deficiencies because the Administration for Children and Families hasn't yet issued its final report, although that's supposed to happen shortly. Numerous steps have been taken to improve the Head Start program and correct major deficiencies in areas of the program that were found to be in noncompliance. And that's according to Cheryl Walsh, who's the chairman and president of the development's board of directors. And so some of the things here, after a monitoring visit in July to respond to staff complaints, federal investigators said that Cape Cod Child Development overshot its Head Start budget, and they were racking up credit card debt while they were also letting work orders to replace unhygienic materials. I think some of those included like ripped sleeping mats for the kids. Mm-hmm. They weren't getting replaced. The program's a pretty big program, too. It serves 295 children in 10 locations on Cape Cod and Nantucket. And during the course that these problems were occurring, it had more than a dozen teacher vacancies, and key staff like the director, the chief financial officer, a disabilities manager, nutritionist, and nurse all left within a year according to investigations. So they're really trying to fix things up there. Let's get these deficiencies solved, get things on track so they can possibly qualify for this contract coming up.
Really briefly, I want to ask you, many stories on the roundup we seem to follow from month to month, from year to year. The proposed pet cemetery in Harwich is one of those, and it's back in the news as town meeting voters will again be asked to vote on it.
Yes, so this had gained a lot of support when it was first proposed in 2016. It's a pet cemetery that's planned for about 2.25 acres on town-owned land on Queen Anne Road. It was originally praised as being really innovative, but this year's town meeting warrant contains dueling articles on the project. One asks voters to fund completion of the pet cemetery and pay off about $70,000 that's already been spent to develop it. Another one, which is a petitioned article, asks that the land be taken from the cemetery commission and returned to the selectmen. And still a third article asks to create a revolving fund that would allow the cemetery to use revenues to pay for construction debts and finance future expansion. There's been a lot of back and forth over whether this is a good idea recently. I think it started off with a lot of support, and then critics are now kind of saying, well, there's a lot of good ideas in theory, but we don't really see a solid business plan. We want to see more numbers. The critics say that, these revenues that are projected to be pretty high aren't really based on anything factual, things that have been presented to them.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Kristen, for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.